So welcome to the third session of Deep Change or Slow Death. This is the third in a seven-part series in an online course that's built on a set of assumptions that drill down deeper and deeper into the work of building a missional culture. We're going to start today's presentation by reviewing the assumptions that are in the course quickly. And we just say to you that a part of your work is to listen to these assumptions. You may even want to listen to them and then go back and listen to them again, record them for yourself, and as you listen to them, test these assumptions in your own thinking. They are our assumptions. Are they your assumptions?
Yeah, and when we use that word assumptions, remember that we're talking about mental models. This is an extension of that conversation. So here are just a few of the assumptions that we are making. The first is that North America has actually become a mission field, and the strategy for reaching a mission field is different from the strategy for reaching a churched culture and or for living in a churched culture.
The second assumption is that culture eats strategy for breakfast.
Yeah, we are just going to have to keep saying that over and over.
Yep.
The third assumption is that mostly we have congregational cultures that developed in a churched context.
Yeah, and the context has changed profoundly. And if context has anything to do with ministry, then that has to be taken into account. Yeah, the fourth assumption is that pastoral leaders must understand what culture is. And how it develops, so that they can disrupt old parts of the culture that need to be disrupted and develop culture in new culture in their specific context. And we are specifically talking about developing a missional culture in your specific context.
And the fifth assumption is that in this course, we're working on five key essential components of congregational culture, with the goal that each part will be strong and functional, and that all the parts interacting together will interact together in a way that produces a missional culture in your congregation.
Yeah. So,
and I think I would just add to that over time.
Over time, yeah. Well, in fact, we would probably add all of this over time. I mean, the deeply held assumptions that we have are often so deeply held that they don't feel like assumptions, they feel like the truth. And we don't give up the truth like flipping a light switch or blinking our eyes. We actually have to think deeply, pray, dialogue with other people, be curious and wonder. All of those things happen. And when I look at my own experience with that, stuff didn't change quickly. But what I could see is as I courageously faced the assumptions, that my thinking about all that evolved over time.
And I think that takes us to the content that we're
exactly
presenting today, because in the introductory session, we talked about exactly this, about mental models and assumptions and how we surface those and test them and even exchange them for others. And then in the first session, we talked about mission and our mental model of mission. And today we move to the second piece, which is narrative. And I think narrative both is a mental model, but also I think we'll be able to see how we shape our mental models through narrative.
Exactly.
And we just want to remind people, these aren't sequential. They're not in any particular order. We've tried to put them in an order that makes sense to us, but each part has a function, it stands on its own, and each part is constantly interacting with all the other parts.
And the interaction of the parts produces something that no individual part can produce.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the big idea for today is we all live inside a story. I want to say that again. We all live inside a story. The ability to unearth the congregation's history and craft it into a repeatedly told narrative. You can't see it, but what I want to do is give you a script that has repeatedly told narrative in bold print and underlined. The ability to unearth the congregation's history and craft it into a repeatedly told narrative that ties history, identity, current reality, and mission that capacity is a core element of creating a healthy culture.
Yeah, when we were putting together some of these ideas, I told you, I love that definition of narrative for our purposes here. If we could get that, if we could get that we live inside a story and that our congregation tells a story that we can shape.
That we can shape. We're not victims to the story.
Right. Yes. Uh-huh. And that we're all always shape. You know, the story is always being told and always being shaped. So I think I want to just start with the very basic idea of narrative, which is the idea that we constantly create stories that we live inside of. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I just think is fascinating is about how we encode memory in our brains and how we store a memory, but then we tell a story about what happened. And that story that we tell can literally change our memory. And every time we retrieve that memory and look at it and tell a story about it, when we put it back, it goes back in a little bit different form. And I just think that that is absolutely fascinating and also proof of the power of narrative.
Yeah, I can think in my own life about how as a young adult, when I first began to have the courage to tell the story about the violence in my home, it was all about the violence in my home. I remember fast forward 30 years, and I'm in a meeting one day where I'm telling my first formation story, and I have a woman, Dawn, who comes over to me, and she says, I've heard you tell that story 10 times over the lifetime of our relationship. And she said, today you talked about the significant role that your dad played in your community mm-hmm. in the civil rights movement. And, and she said, I've never heard you tell that part of the story. Mm-hmm. And what that comment did was it made me look back and see how the story has evolved over time. Mm-hmm. That I only focused on one part of my experience, and that as I grew and matured, as I worked on inner healing, as I worked on all that, that I was able to see more and more parts. And today I have a very different memory of some of those experiences than I did in my 20s.
And so the story is what we tell ourselves.
Right.
Right. It's not reality. We can't recreate reality. And, it's not even necessarily what happened, although I think it is important sometimes to just try to get to the facts. Mm-hmm. But it's the subjective view of how we experienced what happened. And it includes the stories that others have told to us that we are building on. And the stories that we tell are as much about us as they are about what happened. And the reason this is so tricky is that, you know, just like fish don't see water, we often don't see the stories that we're living in, but they're shaping our reality and even shaping our future all the time.
Well, in fact, I mean, I've heard you say on more than one occasion that unless we do this work that we're talking about here, we think our stories are reality.
Right.
And that becomes really complex, because if I think my story is reality, but you experience those same facts differently than I experience them, then what do we do with that? Right.
Yeah.
We can say, oh, well, we experience that differently. And what do we learn from two different experiences of the same reality? But if we can't embrace that, then there becomes this kind of competition of, no, my view of reality is right, and your view of reality is wrong. I think one of the
We call that Facebook.
Maybe so. But the work of the leader is to recognize, a significant part of the work of the leader is to recognize that there are these various stories out there, and finding a way to hear those and to shape a collective story that doesn't make a right or wrong, doesn't make a this is the right story and this is the wrong story, but a story that tells the complexity of what has happened in the life of the congregation is so important.
And we have some control over whether we're telling, to borrow the work of the Crucial Conversations idea that we can tell victim stories and we can tell villain stories that almost never reflect that, like you said, the complexity of what is happening, but we get so attached to our victim stories. You know, we get so attached to our villain stories. And, you know, we can tell, this is your wheelhouse, we can tell empowering stories or disempowering stories. And I'm thinking about a congregation that we were part of that had gone through the experience of a split. Mm-hmm. And the people who split from the church went and created another church down the road, and that church grew like gangbusters. Mm-hmm. And the original church that we were part of never grew again. And this, you know, by the time we came along, that had happened, I think, 25 years previously. Yeah. And one of the things that was fun about that, I thought it was fun, was that our co-author of the first book we wrote together, The Leader's Journey, Robert Creech, was, so I was the wife of the pastor of the first church, and Dr. Creech was the pastor of the other church. And one of the things that we did as we were writing that book was to get people from both churches in a room and have them talk a little bit about the stories that had emerged from that. And the story that the original church told, there were several stories, but one of the dominant stories was those people were obviously right and God blessed them. And they took the blessing of God with them when they left our church. That is a very demoralizing, disempowering story. Mm-hmm. And for some people, that was a villain story, you know, because they left. They are the ones that left. And there was a lot of anger about that. And for others, it was more of a victim story. You know, we don't have anything to offer like they do. And, you know, we're just sitting here on our corner biding our time. And there were individual stories in that, but there was also a collective story. Mm-hmm. And it was just fascinating to me to hear people still 25 years later using the stories that they told to try to make sense of what happened.
Yeah. And so, I mean, we've said several things. We've said we live in a story. We've said the story is not the same thing as reality, but the story becomes reality unless we challenge it. When we work in a congregation, even in a small congregation, you have multiple stories, individual stories, and collective stories, and those stories can be empowering or disempowering. And what I would say is that, you know, we're going to move pretty quickly to what the components of the story are. But what I would say is that one of the important roles in the narrative is to develop an empowering story that increasingly is shared by a larger portion of the congregation, and particularly the leadership of the congregation. Mm-hmm. So said another way, transformation requires that we change our stories.
Yeah, we cannot have deep change. I mean, that's what we're talking about in this mm-hmm. course, deep mm-hmm. change. And I just don't think we can say this strongly enough. We cannot have deep change unless we change our stories.
Yeah. Yep. So let's move then to the component pieces. Let me just name them first of all. Your story is going to have some pieces around history, some around what's current reality, some around the emerging future, and some around the default future. So four components that have to be integrated into one whole. And so let's then go back. The first piece would be history. When you look at the history of the church, even you know, a church plant that's 5, 6, 7 years old. And we work with churches that you know, that have been 150, 175 years old. There's history, and in that history, there's successes and failures. There's key figures. There's big changes. I remember the church that I served in Fort Worth in the 70s. A tornado had hit Fort Worth and had torn the roof off of the building of the worship center of the church that I was serving. And in the storytelling of the church, there was just this really clear demarcation between people who were in the church when the tornado hit and people who came later who didn't have any of that experience. Mm. Looking at all those pieces and parts, what your relationship has been to the denomination, what it's been to the community, how the community has changed over the history of the church, all of those are component pieces of the history of the history component of the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, people that have come and gone, all of that. I'm thinking about in terms of how the story is shaped. I'm thinking about a church that I'm working with right now who is working on their position on the issue of women in leadership. And that position is changing, and they are announcing a changing position related to that. And the church is literally split down the middle. They, you know, have done some really good surveying, through polls and through conversations, and it is literally split 50-50.
Wow.
And, you know, they're in one of those situations where if they change their position, people are going to be upset, and if they don't change their position, people are going to be upset. And so the elders have been in this discernment process for a long time, and right now what they are doing is not trying to argue the position of the issue of women in leadership. What they're doing intentionally right now is working at widely telling a story that we are a church that has always been diverse. We're diverse in a lot of different ways, but one way we're diverse is theologically, doctrinally, hermeneutically, and we have always been diverse, and yet we have held together because of our mission, and we've maintained unity because we have been able to make room for our differences. And so telling that story very strategically is going to be, I think, a much more important story as they navigate this controversy than the story about what is right or wrong about women in leadership.
Exactly, exactly. And so that's really a great illustration of how you take the component pieces of history and tell current reality stories, which is the second piece. So if history is the first piece, current reality is the second piece. I'll never forget, I mean, this really marked me as a leader. I was doing some consulting for a church here in Houston, maybe 30 years ago. And it was back in the early days of, you know, churches were in the worship wars, and they were trying to figure out how they were going to maintain older membership and keep new members and keep attracting new members to the life of their congregation. And in this congregation, they had a pretty significant divide between their oldest adults and their youngest adults. And so we did this weekend retreat, and in the weekend retreat, a part of what we did was we put one of the key leaders of the oldest adults cohort in a small group with the key leader of the youngest adults cohort. And over the course of the weekend, each of them developed a relationship, and they got to tell their story, their church story, their faith story, their sense of what was real and what, you know, what was needed. And at the end of the retreat, the oldest leader was a man, and the youngest leader was a woman, and the oldest leader stood up and said, something like this. He said, you know, I've been really deeply engaged in the conflict over how we're going to do worship. And he said, I'm coming out of this retreat with a little bit different perspective. And he said, my perspective is not different because I want a different kind of worship, but my perspective is different because I've heard Mindy's story.
Mm-hmm.
That experience was really marked me. And then as we began to write the report, the story of the retreat, a part of what was we worked really hard to do was to not try to write the pastor's or the key leader's description of what current reality was. We didn't try to tell their story. What we tried to do was tell the story in a way that said, so we have some older adults who see this, and we have some younger adults who see this. And a part of what we're dealing with is in the life of the congregation is trying to figure out how to merge those two sets of needs and the sets of challenges in a way that take both groups of people seriously. So it's not a view of reality that we're a story that we're telling that we're trying to get everybody to embrace, but it's a story that actually, one of the ways that I say it is that when I read the story, I don't have to agree with everything that's in the story, but I feel like my view needs to be represented there. I need to be able to say, I am somewhere in that story.
But you know, it's so human to hear a story that says, well, the older adults see this and the younger adults see this, and then want to say, okay, but what's the true story?
What's right and what's wrong?
But the story is that both those things exist, and telling that story. And the same complexity emerges, I think, when we talk about our story about the future. Mm-hmm. What is happening? What is God doing? What kind of momentum is there? What experiments are happening? Where are people, out in the world doing the work of the kingdom? And, you know, all of that about what the future of the church looks like. You know, I always think it's interesting. What do you think about this? I don't think that hope necessarily correlates with how many people are still in a congregation or where they're located or how many adult baptisms they've had or whatever, that hope correlates with the story that they are still telling themselves about what a future for their church could be.
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. I think that the research says that what gives us hope, like I can look into the future and if there's a possibility out there that draws me in, then that gives me hope. If I look to the future and the same suffering, the same decline, the same loss, it just seems like as far as I can see, that's what's out there, then it's hard to engender hope in anybody.
Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that vital and vibrant congregations just across the board excel at telling the story of what God is doing now and projecting that into the future.
And I think that's exactly right. I think one of the distinctions that we want to make here, particularly if you've been around church life for very long, there was a time when we began to talk about the church's mission and vision in a changing context where the future that we were going to was a fixed future. It was like, we're here and we're going to go through 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 years of change. But when we get to the other side, there's a really clear destination that we're all describing in our mission and vision words. And we're trying to align the music ministry with that, the worship ministry, the youth ministry with that, and the children's ministry with that. And one of the things that's really fundamentally different in the stories that we're telling these days about the emerging future, in fact, we used to call it the preferred future. And because of that sense that felt so fixed, we're talking about emerging future, is that the story is more of a canoeing the mountains kind of story, is that we're going into a land that we don't know of. And so we're mapping it, we're doing experiments, we're out exploring what's out there, coming back and reporting that. And that's a different kind of story about the future than this fixed destination that we're going to and trying to get everybody to go to with us.
And I think that references the biblical story. I mean, we have the Exodus story, which is a story about, you know, that we leave a bad place and we're going to a good place and it's going to be the promised land and we're all going to get there together.
Right.
Which is a very different story from the Acts story, which is that we're being scattered. We don't necessarily know what's happening other places. We're figuring out how to be outposts of the kingdom in really different circumstances. And, you know, maybe someday someone like Luke will come and tie all those stories together.
Exactly.
But no individual one of us can see the whole story.
We may have already said this in another presentation, but I think it deserves being said here again. This sense of the emerging future and the pace of change that we're dealing in and how that the pace of change is changing, has really given me a new way of reading the book of Acts. like I used to read the book of Acts so the early church, you know, had these widows that weren't being fed, and so they created some deacons, and so we're supposed to create deacons. And then, you know, I mean, like, you could just take several things out of there, but when you find Peter meeting Cornelius, and God's at work out there in the neighborhood, so to speak. And did God use Peter to save Cornelius, or did God use Cornelius to save Peter?
Right.
And so it's just a different way of reading the book of Acts that I think can help this storytelling and empower some of this work.
So
go ahead.
How we use the biblical story matters.
It does. Yeah. It does. Mm-hmm. And so the fourth part, if the first part is history, the second part is current reality, the third part is emerging future, then the fourth part is a default future, where you begin to talk about, you know, if we just keep doing what we've been doing, if we don't change anything, then what does it look like down the road, 10 or 20 years? And you can do that in terms of data. You can do that in terms of statistical trends. You can do that in terms of how the community has changed. There is this, it's in me. I'm not accusing anybody. There is this thing in us that says, if things aren't working the way that I want them to work, the go-to strategy is to work harder at the things we've been doing.
Right.
I'll never forget the first time that I heard somebody say, if you do that, if you work harder and harder at strategies that aren't getting you where you want to go, then you only end up at a place that you don't want to go faster. Wow.
That's great.
Right.
That's
right.
Great.
And so the default future, I mean, there is some sense of, as to go back to your conversation a few moments ago about hope, when a part of what we need to do is to create some sense of urgency for change, and that default future can help with that.
Yeah, I think that the narrative that has to be challenged there, not, I mean, this might be one of those places where I'll just say, because it's wrong. Okay, is the story that
she
says,
hardly ever says that.
I hardly ever say that, but I'm going to say that today, because the story that I think the most common default future story is, if we keep doing what we're doing, if nothing will change, we'll just keep, you know, it,
right.
We'll be able to keep things the way they are right now forever, and that's just factually not true.
Right.
Right. We're going to age, and people are going to die, and new babies are going to be born. And there is no way to say, how do we keep things the way they are right now forever?
Yeah.
And
it takes a lot of courage to face that. It takes a lot of courage to face that. And that becomes even more important. You know, 100 years ago, you might be able to say that and live into that reality for a number of years. You might be able to not change anything and keep things relatively the same, but it is the pace of change in our culture and our context of the world that we live in, that even if you could, even if nobody in the church died and no babies were born and nothing happened in the church, what's happening out in the culture is changing so rapidly. And again, we've said this several times, if context determines what effective ministry looks like, then no matter what, the world is just changing at this unprecedented pace. So in this component, you know, we've been talking about narrative, and we've said that it has four parts: history, current reality, emerging future, and default future. I think we'd conclude by saying there are a couple of really big challenges that leaders have to face in doing this narrative piece. One of them is tying the congregation's mission, which I refer to as the congregation's meta-narrative. So I think we're all familiar with the language that the Christian gospel has a universal meta-narrative. And so as a local congregation begins to determine what its mission is, that becomes the congregation's meta-narrative that connects to the larger Christian meta-narrative. So we do those congregational meta-narratives around mission, and then our vision becomes stories of how this generation of members is living into the meta-narrative, into the congregation's meta-narrative. And so leaders learn in their preaching and in their vision casting and in their individual conversations to tell stories about people in their congregation that are doing the work of the vision of the congregation. I'm thinking about Chip up in Michigan when they began to say, you know, there's a whole group of people around our neighborhood who don't come to our church, and they started this monthly or maybe it was a weekly breakfast that they did, where over time what happened was bankers and homeless people were sitting together at breakfast and sharing stories with one another. And I remember how on multiple occasions I heard Chip, in whether it was listening to a sermon that he preached online or whether it was hearing him talk to a group of people about the changes that they were going through in the life of their congregation, he was saying, you know, here's what our congregation is saying the meta-narrative is for us, like in the universal sense, and this story tells you what our vision is. And you can quote the words of a vision, and people may or may not remember that, but I promise people remember. I remember the story of the banker and the homeless guy sitting and having breakfast together.
Right. And so, yeah, the stories we tell about our meta narrative, about our current narratives, and tying all that together with mission and vision and goals is essential. And then maybe just the last thing to say about paying attention to our narratives is paying attention to the stories that we tell about failure or suffering. Mm. When things have not gone well, I mean, I've been thinking about the tornado story.
Right.
Or the church split story. The stories we tell about pastors who have left and church members who have left and tragedies that have happened in the church. The stories, the meaning that we make that is reflected in the stories that we tell will so powerfully shape not only how the church sees itself and sees its future, but I also think how individual members of the church see their own failure and their own suffering, and their stories will interact with the congregational story. That's just so important.
Yeah, so this component piece is around narrative. And you know, just want to end this presentation by asking, what's the story you tell about the congregation that you're in, about the context that that congregation exists in, about what the emerging future is? As you listen to other people in the life of your congregation, what does it look like for you to kind of listen with one ear and with another ear step back and wonder, so what is the narrative that's here? That helps me to understand what the stories that people are living in, and how do we work together to create some shared narrative that empowers our work. That's the work of this component piece.
So we can't wait to see you and get this conversation started.